This is VOA News, coming to you by remote. I'm Gene Randall. To many in the United States, she was known simply as RBG. And today, they're mourning the passing of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died yesterday at the age of 87 after a long battle with cancer. When she took her place on the bench, she was just the second woman ever to serve on the 9-member court. Ginsburg was appointed by Democratic President Bill Clinton in 1993. She is being praised by bipartisan voices. She was a forceful advocate for women's rights and gender equality, a strong, reliable liberal on the nation's highest court. Chief Justice John Roberts called his colleague a jurist of historic stature, adding, quote, "Today we mourn, but with confidence that future generations will remember Ruth Bader Ginsburg as we knew her, a tireless and resolute champion of justice." Rising from a working-class family in New York, Ginsburg overcame hostility toward women in the all-boys club legal profession to become something of a pop icon and a hero to American liberals, respected across political lines. Just 6 weeks before Election Day, the high court vacancy is certain to touch off a spirited political fight. Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell insists he will hold a vote on anyone President Donald Trump nominates. Mr. Trump himself says there will be no delay in his selection process, clearly wanting quick Senate confirmation vote to get a new Supreme Court justice in place. Trump's November opponent, Democrat Joe Biden, says the next president must do the selecting. As he put it, the voters should pick the president and the president should pick the justice for the Senate to consider. In the meantime, the court vacancy becomes another hot-button issue in Donald Trump's bid for a second term in the White House, with Democrats poised to make it tough for the president and his Republican Party to squeeze in a nomination and a Senate confirmation vote before November. Via remote, this is VOA News. The Trump administration will ban the Chinese apps WeChat and TikTok in the U.S. starting tomorrow night. That will block potential new users from downloading the Chinese-owned platforms over concerns they pose a national security threat. Meanwhile, TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, is in talks over the fate of its U.S. operations. Oracle is pursuing a deal. The Trump administration says all United Nations sanctions on Iran must be restored today. But 13 of the 15 U.N. Security Council members, including longtime U.S. allies, Germany, France, and Britain, say sanctions relief for Tehran will continue. Observers say it appears few countries are likely to reimpose sanctions, which were lifted under a 2015 deal between world powers and Iran, aimed at preventing Tehran from developing nuclear weapons. In 2018, Donald Trump quit the accord, calling it the worst deal ever. It appears more and more likely Britain is headed toward tighter pandemic restrictions. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he does not want another lockdown, but that new limits may be needed to deal with a second wave of COVID-19 infections. The UK has so far lost 42,000 lives to the pandemic, with a case count of 388,000. The worldwide numbers from Johns Hopkins University, close to 30.6 million infections and 953,000 fatalities. The stunning numbers here in the United States, 6.7 million cases as fatalities approach 200,000. Israel is in the first full day of its second national lockdown. It began yesterday with the start of the Jewish high holiday season and is scheduled to last 3 weeks. Israel has reported 179,000 COVID cases and is worried about a sharp rise in new daily cases. The death toll in the Jewish state is put at about 1,200. India's parliament session that began this week for the first time in 6 weeks will apparently be cut short after 30 lawmakers were found infected with the coronavirus. This as the number of infections in the country rose to 5.3 million, with 85,600 lives lost, third highest in the world behind only the United States and Brazil. India recorded more than 93,000 COVID cases in the latest 24-hour reporting period. It's been posting the highest single-day new case numbers in the world since early August. A senior Iranian health official has declared a coronavirus red alert covering the entire country, as daily deaths and cases increase at an alarming rate in Iran. The death toll rose by 144 to almost 24,000 yesterday, while the total number of identified cases spiked to 416,000. The United Nations has agreed to step up monitoring of reported human rights abuses in Belarus. During a highly charged debate before the UN Human Rights Council, European ministers denounced the repression of demonstrations since the August 9th elections in the former Soviet Republic. More news online at voanews.com. There is also a convenient, easy-to-use mobile app. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Ghana, first country that sees all its people as one clear national development agenda and vision to be prosecuted over a period of time. We believe, and I believe, that we are sincere in our motives and the frustrations the people have seen with those who have come before.
A Ghanaian opposition party endorses a presidential candidate for the upcoming December general election.
The Federal High Court and people who will file cases on fundamental rights will have to raise certain objections to this law. And that will not be because people want to support the crime of rape, but that will fundamentally raise the issue of whether the law itself addresses the problem that it seeks to address.
Kaduna State Governor in Nigeria signs into law a new measure to punish child rape convicts.
Right now we're in the middle of a lot of debate around gender-based violence and so on. So I expect them to actually make this just one thing and approach government to actually help in ameliorating the difficulties that women face.
And Botswana amends a law that prevents married women from owning a land. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Ghana's opposition convention People's Party, or CPP, has chosen Ivor Greenstreet as its presidential candidate for the upcoming December 7 general election. Mr. Greenstreet, who is a lawyer, was also the party's presidential candidate in the 2016 elections. He faces a stiff task of challenging incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo from the governing New Patriotic Party, or NPP, and former President John Dramani Mahama from the main opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, or NDC. Analysts say it appears the contest is mainly between the incumbent president and the former president. This after the two parties recently released their respective manifestos before the polls. But attorney Ivor Greenstreet tells me that Ghanaians are tired of the failure of the two parties to effectively administer the affairs of the country and are determined to elect the CPP as the alternative. He also says he plans to implement policies to improve the lives of citizens by putting the West African country on the right path for development and growth.
We are happy that we can be humbled as we continue, as you rightly said, with the historic mission that was begun by the founder of the Republic of Ghana and a great Africanist and Pan-Africanist around the world, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. So we are happy and I am humbled to have the opportunity to continue on that great journey established so superbly by Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, whose birthday we'll be celebrating in a few days' time on Monday, the 21st of September, 2020.
What is your vision for Ghana in the fact that Ghanaians decide this coming December 7th that they repose confidence in you and choose you as the next president of Ghana? What will your vision be?
We wish to create a society based on hard work, discipline, restoration of hope, and integrity, to create opportunity for all our citizens, irrespective of their background or wherever they may be located in this wonderful nation. We're a country blessed with many natural resources: oil, gold, gas, cocoa, timber, diamonds, bauxite, fertile lands, access to water resources, strong human beings. And therefore, we would wish to harness these resources for greater use in provision of opportunity, capacity to progress in your daily life through utilization of these resources more effectively. It's a journey that we are happy to continue with the policies and programs that we are currently working on to achieve these objectives via a manifesto policy platform that we will be bringing out sometime towards the end of next week.
How are Ghanaians reacting to your choice or your election as the presidential candidate of the CPP? I'm asking you this because a lot of Ghanaians are saying that there are two major centers of power in spite of the historical president of the CPP, the governing NPP, and the main opposition, the NDC. CPP plays its role. But do you think CPP has what it takes to defeat these two major parties in the upcoming election?
We're absolutely convinced of this fact. Basically, you may be aware that the Fourth Republic has begun sometime back at the beginning of 1992. And therefore, for 27 years, 28 years, the ordinary Ghanaian has had to endure these two parties who have extended different periods of rule to steer the affairs of the nation at different points in time in the last 27 and 28 years. And the people are not happy. The people of Ghana are desperate for an alternative, not desperate for a replica of these two parties who have failed to provide them with progress and opportunity in their daily lives, but an alternative. Therefore, alternative policies, alternative approaches. There's a higher degree of integrity and honesty. It is only the Convention People's Party which has the capacity to achieve that.
So you think the CPP is it attractive enough that will propel you to become the next president of Ghana? Now, let me ask you this. What should Ghanaians expect from you were you to become the next president? What should be their expectations?
Leadership of honesty, leadership of energy, leadership which ensures that the resources of this nation are utilized for the benefit of creating opportunity, transforming our social sector, transforming our economic sector, making sure that the ordinary Ghanaian is seen to be at the center of affairs, and therefore it is a Ghana first country of meritocracy, a Ghana first country of all inclusiveness, a Ghana first country that sees all its people as one clear national development agenda and vision to be prosecuted over a period of time. We believe, and I believe, that we are sincere in our motives, and the frustrations that the people have seen with those who have come before, we believe, are sufficient fuel to allow us to be chosen. And therefore, we hold dear that opportunity and are humbled by the expectation of that opportunity and are ready to kneel in supplication of throne of service.
Ivor Greenstreet is the presidential candidate for the Ghanaian Opposition Convention People's Party, or CPP. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Dr. Kojo Amoakohene is a practicing attending anesthesiologist in the Greater Hartford area within the Eastern Connecticut Health System here in the U.S. He also works with the At Your Mercy Foundation, an NGO that provides medical supplies, including medications and equipment, to some of the most deprived communities in Ghana and Kenya. Dr. Amoakohene, who recently recovered from the coronavirus, says the drug Halodine played a key role in his recovery. He has since partnered with the Ghanaian government using Halodine to help combat the disease in the West African country. To learn more about his quest to help Ghana and other deprived communities in Africa to combat the disease, I reached Dr. Kojo Amoakohene.
Halodine is you mentioned it, I think it's a good term to use. It is a sanitizer for the nose and mouth that has been safely engineered to be used repeatedly that we know caused coronavirus when we tested it in a U.S. lab here in America. And so that's how we sort of came about the whole idea of Halodine and given the pandemic, given the financial effect, the lives that we've lost. We initially thought we're going to just use this for doctors and frontline workers, but it dawned on us, not just frontline workers and not just doctors' offices and surgery centers, but the entire globe is suffering, right? It's a very safe medication. And that's the idea and how we came about and were able to come up with this product.
How effective is this? And when you used it on yourself and that of your family, what were the results?
When we tested it, it was 99.99% effective or killing of the coronavirus after 15 seconds of exposure. In fact, today in the papers, JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association in the head and neck surgery section have just published a paper talking about the effectiveness essentially of our medication that in terms of killing coronavirus. So we know it's effective. This is not a new drug that we just came up with. It's a medication that we use in hospitals. In terms of the second question you asked, when I use it like today, when I give it to my kids before they go to school, when I use it before I go to work, despite wearing the mask and listening to all the precautions, staying away from people, distancing, spending less time, what we call the 3Ds, distancing, duration, and also diversification, decreasing all the meeting different kinds of people. In spite of all that, people are still getting sick. But we have a drug or a medication that has been demonstrated to be effective against the virus, and that's why we use it.
Dr. Mokwene, has the FDA approved it since it's already been used?
Good question. Halodine has been registered as an over-the-counter medication, just like how Tylenol or Aleve, the main ingredient in our medication called povidone iodine. The data of povidone iodine in killing viruses dates back in the 80s. So that's basically the data that we have, that the fact that it's been registered with the FDA, the fact that this is a medicine that is not just being used in America. In fact, when you go to Japan, one of the provinces, they sold out of the main ingredient in our medication.
With this efficacy that you spoke highly about, why isn't it so popular in this country?
Sometimes when I think about it, from the fact that I'm a medical doctor, right, and I know the science behind it, and I know this is safe medicine, the fact that I use it, right, the fact that hospitals, surgery centers, universities, I've had this question asked me, why, how come it's not out there? In the heat of a pandemic, there's a lot of people coming up with all kinds of medications. So it kind of makes it difficult sometimes to hear the good news. But we've been working on it. We've engaged all kinds of stakeholders. The NFL is okay, for example, for their players to use it. We're getting the names out since we've launched our product. We've engaged a lot of stakeholders. And we believe that it's only a matter of time. I think Halodine is going to cut across the globe. Right now, we engage in many African countries.
How is your home country, Ghana, using this to combat the disease?
Well, that question is one that is kind of dear to my heart, right? I'm a Ghanaian. I was born in Ghana, came to America, graduated from the University of Virginia. So my passion has always been to help people. And thinking about Ghana or Africa as a whole, I thought, we live in the West where we have every medical resources. We are not limited here. But then places like Ghana, with elections coming up, and people cannot vote from home. They cannot mail in their ballots. These are underprivileged areas or parts of the world, right? That people have to go to the booth. And immediately I engaged the government of Ghana. Obviously, being a Ghanaian, I was able to do that. And we had a meeting early in June, and we basically presented to them the government delegation. And so they did their due diligence and recognized that this is actually a good medicine. And so Ghana was able to sort of get on board, study the medication or the product, Halodine. And since then, have been able to register Halodine. And as I speak with you, Halodine is going to be sold in Ghana in helping to combat or prevent the spread of this deadly virus.
Dr. Kojo Amwakuhene is a practicing attending anesthesiologist in the greater Hartford area within the Eastern Connecticut Health System here in the U.S. He spoke with me from Hartford, Connecticut. Governor Nasir Ahmed El-Rufai of Nigeria's Kaduna State has updated the penal code to ensure a convicted rapist of a child under 14 years of age is medically castrated. Local media reports the new law will enable surgical castration as well as bilateral, the surgical removal of a fallopian tube for male and female convicts respectively for child rape and death. Additionally, the state attorney general will also publish the names of the convicts on a sexual offenders database. Hafsat Bama, the Kaduna State Commissioner for Women's Affairs, welcomed the new law, saying it will serve as a deterrent to those who rape children. But Attorney Gloria Bollason, CEO of House of Justice and a human rights activist, says that the new law appears to have been rushed through the State House of Assembly. She also asked that the law might not effectively address the problem for which it was enacted. Attorney Bollason tells me the current law contravenes Nigeria's constitution, which she says outlaws torture.
For me, the first issue to look at is the process in which the government arrived at this law. For anybody who checks the official Twitter handle of the governor, he asked the question that there's going to be stiffer punishment of castration for rapists. What do you see? So he certainly just put it to vote. The process of lawmaking is not an executive issue. It's also not a process for one person to sit and feel, no matter how strongly he feels about a matter, that he can just go about to change the laws all by itself. As to the issue around the punishment, the law is such that it is in direct violation so far with Section 34 of the 1999 Constitution of Nigeria on torture. Because you see, again, while rape is a heinous crime, you have to be able to balance the issue.
Do you think the punishment as instituted or implemented as law by the governor's signature is commensurate with the crime associated with it?
Now, when you look at this crime already, in the context of Kaduna State, where the law is supposed to apply, it is a more stiffer punishment than people who get into kidnapping, for instance. When you look at the state of kidnapping in the state, it's much higher than rape. And so what you want to do is to, in terms of hierarchy, put down the cases, which one is more grievous than the other. If you have a rape situation where the person eventually dies, where the victim eventually dies, then to prescribe a death punishment would make sense because death has resulted from the action. But as far as castration is concerned, I think that it is still debatable as to whether that is an appropriate measure for the crime.
Proponents of the law are of the view that this stiffer punishment will serve as a deterrent to those who plan or might engage in such acts. What are your thoughts?
There is no direct correlation between a stiff punishment and the reduction of crime. There's a play of factors. Otherwise, as you would know, Nigeria is now the third most terrorized country in the world. And the penalty for kidnapping and the penalty for murder are both death sentences. So if the issue about a stiffer punishment is what resolves the problem, then you will not have Nigeria on that kind of rating. So the punishment is not a magic bullet. Punishment is not the only thing that causes the reduction of crime in a society. You have to be able to pull out and eliminate the factors that perpetrate this crime. And I do not see in this law any attempt to remove those factors that have led to the rise of rape cases. So going all the way down to just say, oh, let's increase it, let's stipulate castration as punishment, does not solve the problem. Because, at the end of the day, if you're not able to reduce the rate of the crime, and if by the virtue of a stiffer penalty you have less people reporting, then you probably have done more damage to the situation than helped.
How are people reacting to this law in Kaduna State on the ground currently?
So far, there's a mixed reaction to it. In the legal community, many people do not see this as the right effort to solve a problem that actually exists. For those on the street and those who have been victims of this heinous crime, they would think that this begins to set them on the path of solving the problem. Unfortunately, you know, that's not the reality that's going to happen, and that's not the reality that people will be confronted with. I think that the process in making the law was too hasty. Otherwise, it would have allowed for a situation where people will engage much more before they arrive at the conclusion that they have just concluded. But in the days to come, I see a situation where the courts outside of the Kaduna State Court, the Federal High Court, and people who will file cases on fundamental rights will have to raise certain objections to this law. And that will not be because people want to support the crime of rape, but that will fundamentally raise the issue of whether the law itself addresses the problem that it seeks to address.
Attorney Gloria Balasen is the CEO of House of Justice and a human rights activist. She spoke with me from Kaduna, Nigeria. In Botswana, human rights and women's groups have welcomed as a positive development an amendment of a law paving the way for married women to be landowners. President Mokgweetsi Masisi made the announcement this week. Presidential spokesperson Batlehefi Lekgejang says the land policy reform was a promise the president made to voters in the run-up to the last elections. Current policy, which he says was established in 2015, prohibited married couples from applying for land separately. That is to say, if one had been allocated land, then their spouse cannot apply for that land. Right groups say the amendment was long overdue, contending that the policy was discriminatory. For more reaction about the new reforms, I reached Thapelo Ndlovu, a human rights activist and director of the Community Media Foundation in Botswana.
It is a welcome development because previously women could not be allocated land, free land. You know, we have this system where people are allocated free land, but in the previously it was only meant for men. In terms of, or for one spouse, if I may put it that way. So now it means the other partner can also own land within the marriage.
A lot of people, I understand, have been campaigning for this law to be amended to enable women to own land, saying it is not fair. How significant is this that the president has kept his pledge? Because this is what his supporters have been saying, that it was a pledge he made during the last election and he has kept his pledge. So how significant is this development?
Well, it is important in terms of, although one might say it is just academic, because in the first place, the land itself is scarce in terms of allocation. People take a long time to be allocated land. So they will still be in the queue for such allocation, which means as much as it is a welcome development, it may as well prove to be just academic. But like I say, it is something that we applaud when we look at issues of human rights and women or gender rights.
So why was the law enacted in the first place? What was the reason behind it?
I think it was a matter of trying to shorten the queue for land. Because what the reason was that if you are one family, you don't need to have another allocation. Just one is enough. So now it means it opens up to other people as well. One family can have two plots, which was not the case in the past. So it was just a matter of management of land.
Does this revision make it easy for women to acquire land in terms of the process and the hurdles hitherto that they had to surmount or overcome in order to own land, with the law pretty much for preventing them from doing so?
Not necessarily, actually. It could just be an academic development, but not bringing significant change, because it is not like they are going to go in front of others who have been in the queue already. It just means that when you are in the queue, you still remain where you are, but you now have a right to be in that queue. So that's what it means. It means you have a right to join the queue to look for land, or to be allocated land that is freely allocated to everyone else. So the hurdles will be the same hurdles that men confront, the same hurdles that women who are not actually married confront. So really, it is applaudable, but not really bringing out something significant.
What do human rights activists, and for that matter, other women groups, want to see the government do to smoothen the process, to enable women not to face some of these hurdles that you mentioned in order to acquire land in Botswana?
This one is the first step in terms of making the law fair and balanced for everyone. But I think the next step, maybe in terms of affirmation, one might expect to see maybe government giving preferences to women in terms of either creating special allocations for disadvantaged people like women and disabled or youth.
Will the groups, the women groups and your group, human rights groups, engage the government to ensure that some of these issues that you just enumerated can be addressed?
Yes, I anticipate that. I expect these groups to be motivated by this. I think from here now we can actually try to push further, because we have seen that it is possible to change things. So I expect more kind of activism, more kind of a lobbying to take place. Like right now, we're in the middle of a lot of debate around gender-based violence and so on. So I expect them to actually make this just one thing and approach government to actually help in ameliorating the difficulties that women face.
Thapelo Ndlovu is a human rights activist and director of the Community Media Foundation in Botswana. He spoke with me from the capital, Gaborone. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Tanzania, the presidential candidate for the main opposition party, Chadema, is calling on the National Electoral Commission to ensure an even playing field in the run-up to next month's elections. This after Tundu Lissu accused incumbent President John Magufuli and his governing party, the Chama Chama Pinduzi, of using state resources to campaign. He also says the electoral body threatened to ban his party's campaign if he continues with the criticisms. Officials of the Electoral Commission deny the accusations as being without merit. Lissu's criticisms were backed by other opposition groups. Analysts also say the Electoral Commission fails to enforce the law when officials from the governing party violate them. Dr. Bulendo is a lecturer at St. Augustine's University of Tanzania. He tells me that the National Electoral Commission should ensure all candidates are treated equally during the electoral process.
The criticism from Tundu Lissu are justified because of the situation which is going on here in Tanzania and the experience of Tundu Lissu himself, because Tundu Lissu, for many years, he has been in the field trying to campaign against the effectiveness and the efficient use of resources. And he started his campaign before he joined even politics. So what he has been trying to speak out to criticize the government has been basing on his experience and the research he conducted before he joined politics when he was a lawyer. So to me, I think what he's trying to criticize against the incumbent government is justified.
He also criticized the president for using state resources to campaign. But where do you draw the line as a president? He is the president until the election is over, correct?
Yes, correct. You know, the problem we see here in Tanzania, and it is a challenge, when we see one of the candidates is campaigning on the field while he is on the power. President Magufuli is a president, and at the same time he is a candidate for the presidential post. So sometimes when he go out to the field and he sees the situation is not good or is difficult from the voters, he's trying to change his position from being the candidate and stand as the president of the United Republic of Tanzania. For example, 3 days ago, when he was in Geita, he decided to appear in front of the voters as the president and not as the candidate. To me, as an analyst here in Tanzania, I think it is totally unfair. Because where do we define Magufuli as a candidate, and where do we define Magufuli as a president? I think the law should draw the line between when the candidate is supposed to speak as the president and when the candidate is supposed to speak as the contestant for the presidential post. There is a need here in Tanzania to recheck our legal system, to recheck our constitution, especially during the campaign. All candidates should be treated equally because of the way President Magufuli sometimes he acts as the president while he's on the ground selling out his manifesto, trying to convince the voters. He's not supposed to act as a president. He's supposed to act as a candidate for the presidential post.
You said every candidate should be treated equally. Do you think the National Electoral Commission in Tanzania, or NEC, is treating all the candidates equally and fairly for the elections?
NEC is trying, but not absolutely, for 100% treating all candidates equally. Because of what? We have been sometimes see some of the ruling party candidates trying to use the power. For example, not only the president, even some of the candidates at the MP level those who are trying to, they are contesting for the to be the member of the parliament, they are still ministers. When they go out to the field, they use that power of being the ministers to sell out the manifesto or their promise to the voters. That is the challenge we see. And we don't see the intervention of the National Electoral Commission here in Tanzania to resolve that problem or to intervene and tell the candidates that you are all equal. And it has been the problem here in Tanzania since 1992, when our nation decided to legalize multi-party system here in Tanzania. Why sometimes you see someone is contesting to be the member of the parliament, but when he is on the stage selling out his or her manifesto, he used his power or her power as a minister to convince the voters. The same with the presidential posting. We see sometimes someone is contesting and he or she using the power as a president to convince the voters. And we don't see any measures taken by the NELC to harmonize the situation, to intervene and to make the campaign fair to all candidates. And also, we don't see the policymakers, the activists, even the peacemakers here in Tanzania trying to intervene and finding the solution, because it has been the problem, it has been the big complaints from the opposition side that sometimes the NEC is still silenced while other candidates, they're not playing fair game. I think NEC should do something extra to make it clear and to harmonize the situation.
Dr. Bulendu is a lecturer at St. Augustine's University of Tanzania. He spoke with me from Mwanza, Tanzania. A Ugandan writer and critic of the government has been arrested for the second time this year, according to his lawyer. The lawyer says the move was prompted by an unpublished manuscript that details the writer's arrest, detention, and alleged torture in April by military personnel. For VOA, Halima Atumani reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
On Friday morning, security personnel thought to be from Uganda's Chieftaincy of Military Intelligence stormed the home of novel writer Kakwenza Rukirabashaija and took him into custody. His lawyer, Aaron Kiza, spoke to VOA in a phone interview.
He has been arrested this morning at 6:30 for continuing to write, because he has been promising to publish the new book on Banana Republic that recounts his previous torture in April. And they arrested him in the presence of his wife and also in the presence of the chairman of the area.
This is the author's second arrest this year. The first was in April when he was taken into custody of a fiction book titled The Greedy Barbarian. The book describes a young man who leaves the countryside, rises to power, and is overtaken by greed and ego, leading to his demise. Many saw it as a commentary on President Yoweri Museveni. Rukirabashaija spent 7 days in military custody. Upon his release, he started drafting another book, The Banana Republic, in which he details his arrest, detention, and alleged torture. In the draft, partly shared with VOA, he recounts what he describes as horrendous and indescribable torture while in custody. He writes that one day, an officer kicked him off a toilet and then pushed his face inside the bowl. He says the officer then reached for the keys in his pocket and chained me on the bars that were out of the toilet wall, and I spent the night there praying to God. Writing is not a crime. It is not a crime to be creative. Danson Kahiana is president of the Uganda chapter of PEN International, a writers' association. He says Rukirabashaija's arrest is a clear message from government to writers that they will not tolerate dissenting and critical voices.
By the time they even reach that level of arresting you for a book that has not yet come out, I think it shows that we have really lost it. We're supposed to be governed, and governing does not mean oppression. It's very unfortunate to see that we are going back to the dark days that Museveni supposedly liberated us from.
VOA reached out to branches of the army and police for comment. The officials contacted said they have no information on the writer's alleged arrest. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Somali leaders have agreed on a process for holding the country's elections beginning in November. The decision follows weeks of disagreement between the Somali government and regional leaders on how to proceed with parliamentary and presidential elections that are due in less than 5 months. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf has more from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
After months of negotiations between the Somali government and five federal states, political leaders have agreed on a slightly revised electoral system for the coming elections. The system will retain the 4.5 power-sharing formula that gives equal representations in parliament to the country's four major clans and a smaller number of seats to so-called minor clans. Each clan will choose its members of parliament through special elections. Then, the 275 lawmakers will elect the president. The major changes is that elections for each parliament seat will involve 101 delegates, up from 51 in 2016. Senator Ilyas Ali Hassan, a member of the opposition Himilo Karan Party, says he's happy with the arrangement, but it would have been better if Somalia elected their leaders by party instead of clan. This is an improved electoral model. There are 101 delegates, and the election centers will take place in two cities within the federal states. He says, that's fine, but we're a political party, so at least to improve our democracy, we thought it would have been better if those competing for the political seats ran for those seats using political parties. Omar Mahmoud is a senior analyst on Somalia at the International Crisis Group. He says the 50 extra delegates in the parliament elections will make a difference.
We saw a lot of corruption and manipulation in 2016 elections. And so there's, you know, an impetus behind trying to have that indirect process still, but adjust it a little bit so we overcome some of the issues we saw last time around. But overall, it's a very positive step to get the country going forward.
The leaders agreed on 15 points in all. Mahmoud says some of the provisions may pose problems as they are unclear.
The relation of the federal electoral commissions and state level commissions, that relationship is not very clear. The roles and responsibilities will have to be expounded completely. I mean, it basically means that we're bypassing the National Independent Electoral Commission yet again, but developing new bodies in such a short amount of time, that's going to be quite complicated. Another aspect would be the selection process about the electoral delegates. The civil society and the member states and elders are going to be involved, but again, the details on some of that come about will be key.
The deal also preserves the rule that 30% of parliament seats must go to women. The deal puts an end to hopes that Somalia could adopt one-person, one-vote elections. President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo is believed to have been in favor of that, but critics say the goal was unlikely due to tensions between Mogadishu and other regional states, security challenges, and lack of technical ability to roll out elections across the country. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Happy Blowsy, kipenzi changu changama, nina wewe hadi milele. Komesha wachokozi, wabaki kututazama, tuwatowe jasho la nywele.
For you. label you when you're under. It's Ferris, Gary and Sugar, do what you want and complain later. Claim for God, I know go busy but the hammer. If I want it, they go ready for Shia. When some can go ready for Bia. No go wear shorts, single tie lapper. No go make up, but she ain't real beauty. But you don't know, it's not going to be for party. I go protect you just like condom. Treat you right and build your mansion. The way we want you, tell them, go sleep. And tell them, we love switching them too deep. All my notes, them, I want no man I can keep. But pretty girl, when I give me hot dog pick.
They don't beat me for you. And they kill me for you. They even swear me for you. Still it's a while for you. They don't beat me for you. And they kill me for you. They even swear me for you. Still it's a while for you. Baby, I they have for you. Baby, still it's a while for you.
Save you, plus gold, I go make you sweat. Put smile on your face, you're not gonna upset. Show you real love, but you're not gonna regret. I go only let one egg, you're not gonna broke on me hand. Put spring on your finger, the left hand. Not gonna promise anything, I'm not gonna fulfill. I'm ready for go jail for you, sick, for go don't kill. For you, I'm not gonna keep two man, I just you. And I go make sure stay stick. I never regret the fact that I met you. Just wanna love you and not stress you. Go the extra mile just to please you. Guide you, control you, protect you. Not gonna let other woman for my less you. Put it in a bag, girl, I go dress you.
They don't beat me for you. They kill me for you. They even swear me for you. Still it's a while for you. They don't beat me for you. They kill me for you. They even swear me for you. Still it's a while for you. Baby, I they are for you. Baby, still it's a while for you. Even if the rain come, I am.
was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, no one drinks medicine on behalf of a sick person. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.